New York City, 1979. Rikers Island, the visiting quarters of the men's house of detention. Two men sit in a cell. One of them is the occupant. One of them is just visiting. The prisoner is friendly, happy to have a visitor, and he seems at ease with the surroundings. The visitor has pulled a lot of strings to be here. 8 layers of bureaucracy is how he put it later on in an interview. But still, professional success has earned him a lot of clout, and this is him using it. He's a film director. They exchange small talk at first. In the prisoner's previous life, the director had known him as a medical technician. Good at his job, efficient, but with a caring manner that set patients at ease.
Regan, can you sit up? Scoot over here. A little more. Good. Regan, I'm just going to move you down on the table, okay? That's just for a short time.
It's one of the reasons the director used him in his film, to play himself, really. Critics then and since have commented on how realistic that particular scene was. And some have even said it was more disturbing than the rest of the movie, which is considered to be one of the most disturbing films of all time. The conversation eventually turns to why the prisoner is at Rikers awaiting sentencing. That's why the director is here. This isn't about a film role or rights to a story. He was genuinely shocked when he read about what became of his actor, and curious as to what happened exactly. He had seemed like such a normal guy. But he had brutally murdered someone. And to the director's shock and unease, he begins talking about another, different murder. I remember killing this one guy. I cut him up, and I put his body parts in a plastic bag, and I threw it in the East River. That's the only one I remember, but they want me to confess to another 5 or 6, the prisoner says casually. The director asks the prisoner what he's going to do. The prisoner pauses for a minute and then says, "Well, I'm thinking it over, because if I confess to 6 or 7 of these, they'll lower the sentence." That doesn't make any sense to the director, and he says so. Why would the prisoner get less of a sentence for confessing to more murders? So they could get headlines that 12 unsolved murders were now solved, he says matter-of-factly. It sounds iffy. The prisoner just added at least 5 more murders to the score with that statement. And the director wonders how reliable a narrator the prisoner actually is, even if it is his own story. He definitely killed someone, though, and they eventually discuss that crime. The director left Rikers that day inspired by the conversation and determined to do something. There was a certain novel that he'd been debating adapting into a film whose subject matter was somewhat similar to the prisoner's story. Gay men, unsolved murders, a little-known subculture, and a policeman in the middle of it. The subject matter was fairly taboo, and studio execs might balk initially at financing it, but the director was responsible for what was now considered to be the greatest horror movie of all time. He knew that he could get pretty much any movie made at this point. That movie was 1973's The Exorcist. The director's name? William Friedkin. The prisoner? His name was Paul Bateson. You're listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jay Harvey. This episode of Wicked Gay is about two movies, and the man who appeared in one and partially inspired the other. It's about how an average ordinary guy, seemingly with his whole life ahead of him, can surprise everybody by spiraling down so far that he ends up in a prison cell, convicted of one brutal murder, and more chillingly suspected of more. The first movie, like I said, you probably heard of it, 1973's The Exorcist. The second you might not have. It's called Cruising. This is episode 7, Cruising the Exorcist, Paul Bateson. Okay, so spoiler alert, The Exorcist. It's about a 12-year-old girl who is possessed by a demon named Pazuzu, her terrified mother who desperately wants to save her, and the two priests who try to. It's a brutal, graphic movie, and nothing like it had ever been seen in theaters at that time, and since, really. It was a huge controversial hit, and it changed not just the horror genre, but cinema forever. So in the book as in the movie, the little girl, whose name is Reagan, she's taken by her mom, Chris, to a battery of doctors after she suddenly starts exhibiting like horrifying symptoms like spasms, speaking in different voices, extreme self-abuse, I won't talk about the crucifix, and violence toward others. And they're not sure if her issues are neurological or psychiatric. One of the reasons The Exorcist is so effective is that it's very grounded in reality at first. Ellen Burstyn is awesome as the mom, and as is Linda Blair as the daughter, the initially cute little girl. And Single Mom and Daughter seem like Single Mom and Daughter in 1973. They really sell it. You can absolutely see why, too, the mom would start taking her to every doctor possible to find out what's wrong with her daughter. And there's not really any fantastical elements in the film at first that betray what's really happening to Reagan. That is until her head starts doing the 360. So, in 1972, director William Friedkin, the guy from the opening, he's just about to start filming his movie. And in the interest of keeping everything as realistic as possible, I mean, that is until the little girl's head starts spinning about, he decides he wants to be extremely accurate with depicting some of the medical procedures that Reagan undergoes in the film to add to that grounding kind of sense of reality. So he goes to what is now known as the Tisch Hospital in New York City to watch some. One of the procedures he watches, was called a cerebral angiography. It's a procedure to x-ray to see if your arteries are blocked and you're about to have a stroke, basically. Today, they do this by inserting a catheter through your groin, arm, or shoulder. I'll take the arm or shoulder. But back in the day, they went through the carotid artery in your neck. So any of you who've seen this movie can probably recall the scene because it is disturbing. So Friedkin watches Dr. Barton Lane and his team perform a carotid angiogram. I mean, it was a gruesome procedure to watch back then. A large needle, trigger warning here for gross stuff, would be inserted into a patient's neck full on. And in the moments between the arterial puncture and the insertion of the catheter, blood would freely issue from the tube in rhythm with the patient's heartbeat. So there'd be a sizable spray of blood every time. And Friedkin watched this and he loved it and thought it would be perfect for his movie, which was a horror movie after all. Friedkin is so taken with this procedure that he decides to use the doctor and his entire team in the movie just doing that. So he'll just throw Linda Blair on the table and there you go. And in addition to the doctor and the nurse, there's a technician. His name is Paul Bateson. So he's in The Exorcist in that scene. And his presence in the movie contributed to what they call the Exorcist curse. So you see, all sorts of negative stuff happened during the filming. From the house set burning down, except for Reagan's room, which, ooh, spooky, to Friedkin permanently injuring Ellen Burstyn through a stunt gone wrong. And that's her actual scream of pain they use in the movie, which is how authentic, but kind of mean to do. To two actors whose characters die in the movie actually died in post-production. And then Max von Sydow, who plays Father Merrin, the older priest, and Linda Blair, they both had close relatives die during the production. Max's brother and Linda's grandfather. Max's brother actually died in the first day of filming. Linda received death threats after the movie came out. She had to have bodyguards for 6 months, so that could have been kind of a PR thing, you know, made up by the promoters. And actress Mercedes McCambridge provided the voice of the demon. Unfortunately, her son murdered his entire family and then killed himself in 1987. At one showing of the movie, a woman was so frightened that she passed out in the theater and broke her jaw when she fell. And she later sued the studio for upsetting her with subliminal messaging. By the way, ma'am, Pazuzu wasn't subliminal. I could plainly see him in the movie, just like I could plainly see the two dicks in Fight Club. That wasn't subliminal. And they really got a Catholic priest in to bless the set because everybody was so freaked out. And a major part of the Exorcist curse is a cast member brutally murdering someone. That was Paul Bateson. Paul Bateson was born on August 24th, 1940. He grew up in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. He later jokingly told a reporter from the Village Voice that his role in the film was sort of a getting revenge on his dad type thing, because he would punish him as a kid by making him stay home from Saturday matinees and listen to opera on the radio. Despite it supposedly being a punishment, culture of that sort obviously rubbed off on Bateson. When he was at Rikers, he complained to the same reporter that his major gripe about being in prison for murder was missing the Joffrey Ballet. I mean, I would have thought that freedom would be the major complaint there, but maybe he liked the free rent. Bateson joined the army after high school and was stationed in Germany in the early 1960s, and he began drinking like a fish out of boredom. Unfortunately, that began a lifelong struggle with booze. He moved to New York City in 1964, although he would later describe himself as not exclusively gay, saying that, quote, "I just float in the world." Is that a sexuality? He began a long, drunken relationship with a guy in the music industry, sloshing away the hours drinking cocktails at the Pierre and throwing frequent parties at their home and at Cherry Grove on Fire Island. It sounds like Paul was living that life, which makes what happened to him even more unfortunate. During that period, though, his mom died of a stroke and his younger brother committed suicide. Bateson eventually became a neurological radiological technician and got a job at the New York University Medical Center, which is now called Tisch Hospital. That's where Friedkin saw him do his thing. He noted later that he seemed like a nice young man who stood out due to his earring and studded bracelet, and he put him in his movie along with his co-workers. Bateson was well-liked and respected by his co-workers, with Dr. Lane, the neuroradiologist who performed the procedures, saying he was the best tech he ever worked with. A few months later, Friedkin and crew shot the scene. They blocked off part of the hospital's radiology unit for 2 weekends in a row. It was one of the first scenes they shot. Dr. Lane later recalled hearing that the crew was still trying to figure out how to make Reagan's head spin effectively. I'll be honest, I knew it was a trick. The year the movie came out, 1973, is also the year his relationship with his drinking buddy ended. He moved to the Brooklyn neighborhood of Borough Park and kept drinking, to the detriment of his social life. As he put it, nobody likes a drunk, which isn't true, I live in Boston. Speak for yourself, Paul. The booze caught up with him, and he was fired from his job at New York University Medical Center in 1975. He moved to Greenwich Village, existing on odd jobs like light repair work and cleaning apartments. He also worked the box office at a porn theater. They had porn theaters back then. It was like the 70s, so things were still sleazy. He started drinking about a quart of vodka a day, and it began to render him housebound for the most part. But some nights he was able to make it outside. He would mostly patronize leather bars, which he'd been doing since 1970. So for those of you not in the know, leather bars are gay bars where the patrons normally wear leather. And sometimes it's just a fashion preference, and sometimes it's a sex thing, and what have you. Bateson preferred hanging out with, quote, bikers, and he had an issue with gay guys who were overly effeminate, saying that they give gays a bad name, like any other extreme group would. Let's leave Paul at the leather bars for a minute and get to know somebody else in this story. His name was Addison Verrill. He was from Hamden, Connecticut, went to Princeton, where he majored in English. After Princeton, he spent 3 years in Nigeria with the Peace Corps, and when he got back, he went to work as a journalist and critic in the film industry. He ended up working at the famous trade paper Variety for a decade. On September 14, 1977, Addison Verrill's brutalized body was found in his Horatio Street apartment in the West Village of New York City. He had been beaten and then stabbed to death. Police noted signs of a struggle, but discovered nothing of value had really been taken. Also, they thought. There was no evidence of forced entry. It appeared as if Verrill had let the killer into the apartment as like a social type thing or a date. There were several empty beer cans and half full liquor glasses. Gay activist and journalist Arthur Bell was a friend of Verrill's. He wrote an article about the case in the Village Voice, tying it into the murders of gay men, which had happened recently, several of which occurred yearly in the village. Murders which, as you can guess, were rarely taken seriously by cops or noted by the media because they were always assumed to be the result of hookups gone wrong. Bell reported that the police had determined that Addison Verrill had been at the mineshaft until 6 a.m. the morning before. Addison's other friends told the writer that Addison wasn't exactly into the leather scene as it related to sex, but he did like the attitudes of many of the patrons. Well, okay, but it turned out that Addison was a regular at many of these places, usually holding court at the same corner table. And he was kind of a big deal on the scene. He worked for Variety, etc. Probably knew some actors, whatever, movie stars. The Village Voice, by the way, was the nation's first alternative weekly newspaper. It was kind of a hippie paper for the arty underground subculture cool types. It was the kind of periodical where you could leave your phone number at the end of the story you wrote and encourage anyone with information about the murder of your friend to give you a ring, which Arthur Bell did. And 8 days later, someone gave him a ring. The killer. The anonymous caller wanted to get one thing straight right off. "I like your story and I like your writing," the caller told him, "but I'm not a psychopath." Bell had suggested that Addison's killer was a psychotic who targeted gay men. I guess that wasn't the case. Or so he said. The story that Bell wrote about his convo with the killer ran on the Village Voice's front page. The killer told the whole story of what happened that night and why it ended in Verrill's murder. "I'm gay and I needed the money and I'm an alcoholic," he said. Whether because he thought there was a reward for the info he was giving Bell about himself, or he was explaining why he got out that night, who knows. He told Bell that he had broken 3 months of sobriety by going out to a Christopher Street bar called the Badlands in the early morning of September 14th. Addison, whom he didn't know, bought him a beer. That beer became two, and then many, and they also began doing poppers and coke. They left Badlands at 3 a.m. and went on to the mineshaft, where they kept drinking and drugging. The killer told Bell that he was surprised and impressed by how popular Addison was with the crowds in the bars. He wanted to go home with him, and he did so. So they cabbed to Virill's place, even though the killer said Virill wasn't really into it because he had to get up early in the morning and work on a story, or that was the excuse he used. Anyway, they drank more, did more coke, and they consummated their short relationship around 7:30 a.m. The killer said that afterward it was apparent that this was just a one-night stand on Addison's part. Which, yeah, duh. This might have been a no-brainer to anybody else, but the killer was hurting, a lonely, destitute alcoholic. Drunk and high, he's probably felt very empty. I needed money and I hated the rejection, is how he put it to Bell. So, he said, he decided to do something he'd never done before up until then, or so he claimed. He got a frying pan from the kitchen, and he suddenly hit Addison with it. And when Addison was down, he began stabbing him with what I'm assuming was a kitchen knife that he got where he got the big pan from. He told Bell, the writer, that he had stabbed the wrong part of Addison's chest, which can be inferred that he meant he was aiming for the heart, I guess. Arthur Bell described his recounting of the murder as if the killer was describing the plot of a two-act play starring himself and Addison. It was that casual. After Addison was dead, the killer took $57 in a credit card, Addison's passport, and some clothes. He bought liquor with the money and got drunk the next day, all day, and went to a bathhouse the next night. Later on, Bell got confirmation from another source who had seen the killer there. The killer then gave Bell some details about himself. He said that he was the son of an orchestra leader, was married with a wife in Berlin who didn't understand him, and was the father of a teenage son. As was discovered later, these seemed to have all been lies. He said he liked the arts and had wanted to be a dancer when he was growing up. The killer told Bell that he wanted to atone for the crime several times, which he connected to the conversation taking place on Yom Kippur, which is the Jewish Day of Atonement. "But I don't want to give myself up," he said. "I wouldn't be able to practice again. I'd lose my license." He wouldn't tell Bell what sort of practice the license was for because it would help identify him. Could it have been something medical? Who knows? I do. So, after hanging up with the guy who claimed to have murdered Addison Virill, Arthur Bell immediately called the police to tell them about his new phone friend. The cops confirmed that it could have been the killer. He mentioned the stolen credit card, which the cops had purposely kept out of the press, so they could weed out the wackos who tend to confess to murders that they didn't do. The killer had also mentioned a white substance that the cops had found on the floor of Addison Virill's apartment. The cops had no clue what it was until the killer identified it to Bell as Crisco. And let's just say they probably weren't using it to grease pans for baking. The cops thought that the killer would call Arthur Bell again. I mean, can you imagine the guy? Look at this. Imagine this guy put his phone number in the paper at the end of a story in the Village Voice. His personal phone number. Imagine the crazies he had calling his place in any era but New York City in the 70s? Jesus. The cops staked out Bell's apartment, waiting for the talkative killer to call back. The killer didn't, but a guy calling himself Mitch did. Mitch called to say that he knew who the killer was. He'd gotten to know him when they were in detox at St. Vincent's Hospital a few weeks earlier. The man had been introduced to him as Johnny Johnson, which is probably the worst alias I've ever heard in my life. And he knew the guy was an unemployed x-ray tech who also used the name Paul Bateson. Mitch the snitch wanted to meet Bell in person, but the cops were like, don't bother. They merely drove over to Bateson's 12th Street apartment, and they found him drunk, and they slapped his ass in cuffs. And when they asked him if he knew why they were there and he was being arrested, he pointed to an open copy of the Village Voice with Bell's article in it and said that was probably why. So the police got a handwritten signed confession from Bateson and they charged him with second degree murder. Arthur Bell visited Paul Bateson about a month later. As I mentioned in the opening, Bateson was sort of okay with being in prison. He told Bell that it helped him to stop drinking. Bell, obviously finding Bateson to be kind of cutesy, told him that he probably would have gone home with him like Addison Virill did if he met him in a bar and not during an anonymous phone call murder confession. That's such a gay guy thing to do. I mean, I'm acquainted with gay guys who are like, I know he did XXX nightmarish thing, but I still would. It's like, girl, no. In this go-round with Bell, Paul Bateson didn't want to talk about the murder, but he did talk about his upcoming trial. Despite his signed confession, he had pleaded not guilty. Through his attorney, he'd filed pretrial motions to have his confession suppressed. His argument was that he was trashed at the time, and that the cops didn't read him his rights. He was also now denying that he had been the man who called Bell, and that his confession was just him regurgitating what he'd read in the Village Voice. He told Bell that he was confident he would be found not guilty. "A lot of people will be hurt," he said. "Parents, friends. Then I'll tear up my roots and settle somewhere else. Confidence is key, Paul." And that was seemingly that, except it wasn't. Around the time of Bateson's getting snagged by the cops, they'd been investigating a series of murders of gay men in the city over a 2-year stretch. They thought it was one murderer due to similarities in the crimes. 6 bodies had been found dismembered, in bags floating in the Hudson River. They weren't able to ID any of the men, which is horrifying, but they were able to trace some of their clothing to shops in Greenwich Village, shops that were frequented by gay clientele. I'm picturing every single overpriced shop in the South End with like the $200 crop tops for gym bunnies that read helium heels. You know those ones? It was reported that some of the trash bags or bags read that they were property of or from New York University Medical Center's neuropsychiatric unit. Sound familiar? And the bodies looked to have been dissected by someone with knife skills. Those clues led cops to begin publicizing, they said this aloud or to the press, that they believed Paul Bateson, the killer of Addison Burrell, was a prime, that they were holding him as a prime suspect. They were calling the murders the Cuppy murders, C-U-P-P-I, standing for Circumstances Unknown Pending Police Investigation. That's a weird acronym. And I understand the NYU Medical Center link because he used to work there, but the knife thing, do radiological techs get surgical training? Or does their schooling involve butchering meat? Do you have to know how to dissect a human being to run x-ray equipment? The mind boggles. Early in 1979, Bateson goes on trial. Even though he had predicted that it would be a long Manson-length trial, it only took the jury 4 days to convict him on March 5, 1979. The prosecutor at his sentencing waxed amateur psychiatrist and called Bateson a psychopath, and said that he believed Bateson was responsible for 6 other murders, the bag murders, while admitting there was no direct proof against him. Not to defend Bateson, but you sort of need that law guy. He did claim that Bateson had confessed the bag murders to a friend named Richard, who had testified at Bateson's trial that Paul had confessed Addison Verrell's murder to him. Jesus, Bateson was just telling everybody about the murder. The lady down at Dunkey's probably knew he scragged that guy. Here's what the prosecutor had to say at the sentencing. He told Mr. Ryan that killing is easy, that getting rid of the bodies is the hard part. He said that he cut up his victims and put the parts in plastic garbage bags to dispose of them. I would also point out to the court that the police have evidence that there were 6 bodies, torsos of which were found floating in the Hudson River, wrapped up in plastic garbage bags, Hoyt continued. In all 6 cases, examiners have said that the person who cut up those bodies was a person who was either a butcher or a person with medical knowledge because of the way the cuts were done. Bateson officially denied any role or knowledge about the other murders, so he must have turned down the deal that he told William Friedkin about. Speaking on his own behalf, he said, "I still contend that I am not guilty of the crimes, and I am not the person described by Mr. Hoyt at all. I feel a great loss for Mr. Verrell, and I am not at all the type of person as he has described me." Bateson got 20 years to life in prison, which was 5 years less than the minimums the state asked for. The judge decided that the story about Bateson's connection to the other murders was too ephemeral to consider when sentencing Bateson. Meanwhile, let's go cruising. I kind of like being the tour guide for the people who might not know all the terminology involved in the gay thing. So cruising is also a word besides, you know, being on a boat. It's also a word for checking out a guy that you want to have sex with. So that's what cruising means in gay terminology, the gay lexicon. And you're welcome. As a result of his conversation with Bateson, William Friedkin decided that it was time to make the film adaptation of New York Times reporter Gerald Walker's 1970 novel Cruising about a police officer going undercover in the gay community to catch a serial killer. So life had already somewhat imitated art at this point. An NYPD cop named Randy Jurgensen had, like the novel, gone undercover in the leather bars to catch the Cuppy bag murderer who was later thought by the cops to be Paul Bateson. This, the leather bar scene, his connection to someone who might have been murdering his way across it, all of that intrigued William Friedkin. He also knew the owner of the Mineshaft, which was sort of the crown jewel club of the leather bar scene in the gay community in the 70s. And the guy who owned it was a mafia don, and it wasn't unusual for mafia types to own gay bars back then. It was kind of a regular thing. He ended up, he was allowed to visit the Mineshaft, which is a members-only club, but not allowed to film in it. So the scenes and cruising at the Mineshaft were actually filmed at the heterosexual sex club, the Hellfire Club. Like I said, when I say let Friedkin visit, the mineshaft was members only. It was a sex club that was in NYC's meatpacking district, grow up, on Washington Street. And I could go into what went on there, but this is a family podcast. Let's just say it was pre-AIDS and leave it at that. There's a Wikipedia entry if you're interested. No judgment. Okay, so cruising. Al Pacino's a cop going undercover to catch a serial killer who is chopping up gay guys and throwing them into the Hudson. Literally, there's an arm floating in the beginning. His girlfriend is Karen Allen, who's Marion from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he won't tell her what he's up to, other than it's draining the life out of him. It's very tough being around gay people, obviously. So, that's sarcasm. So, Pacino gets deep, no pun intended, into the gay S&M scene, the culture, and he's got the regalia on, the leather, and taking part in the hanky code. Oh, I should pause here and say the hanky code. So, back in the day, and I guess even now, you could tell, we're such a silly community, but it's necessary sometimes. You could tell what a guy was into sexually by the color handkerchief he wore in his back pocket and which pocket he wore it in. The straight people in the audience are like, what? Really? Yeah, it's called the hanky code. Look it up. Anyway, I'm just laughing. So Pacino's got the leather on and the tank tops and the studded cuff on his arm, and he's in the bars and dancing really badly to the inexplicable punk rock music playing. And let me tell you, Cruising has the weirdest soundtrack. It's all punk bands, which is kind of cool. Like the Germs are on the Cruising soundtrack. But let me tell you, there was no way that they were playing punk rock in gay bars in the 70s. Let me tell you, Donna Summer was in those speakers completely. That or silence. And the movie's pretty much a mess with dialogue like this.
How big are you?
Party size.
What are you into?
I go anywhere.
I don't do anything.
That's cool. Hips are lips.
And like this.
Come up here. I want to show you my nightstick.
Although the trailer is sublime.
A New York City detective in search of a killer is about to disappear into the night.
Is it dangerous?
I can't talk about it.
How do you know you're going to end up the same person when it's over?
The best scene in the movie, though, is the obviously heterosexual Al Pacino jerkily trying to rev himself up by dancing with other dudes, and he's snorting poppers off a bandana. I wish there were GIFs. So the movie sort of kind of made it look like all we gay guys do is wear chaps and blow each other in the bushes and tie each other up and stab each other. Which, spoiler alert, we don't. Not all the time. It became this infamous movie even while Friedkin was shooting it. Throughout the summer of 1979, NYC's gay community protested against the production of the film. These started at the urging of Arthur Bell in the Village Voice. He had written a series of articles on the unsolved murders of gay men that were inspiring the film. And he wrote what came to be the most widely circulated description of the production. He wrote that Cruising promised to be the most oppressive, ugly, bigoted look at homosexuality ever presented on the screen. So that's pretty damning. So the gay community was urged to disrupt the filming, and gay-owned businesses were told to bar the filmmakers from their premises in NYC. People attempted to interfere with filming by pointing mirrors from rooftops to ruin lighting, blasting whistles and air horns near locations, and playing loud music. 1,000 protesters marched through the East Village, yelling for the city to withdraw support from the filming. And as a result of the interference, the movie's audio largely had to be overdubbed because they wanted to remove the sound of the protesters. Because we gays don't mess around, we're pissed off about something. Nevertheless, anyway, so Friedkin's career took a hit that he never quite recovered from, and it was a box office bomb anyways. Now it's become sort of a cult classic, and some critics have upgraded their opinions of the film, noting that it's a gritty look at a subculture during a certain era. Never mind that it hints that we're all serial killers, and that Al Pacino's character might have turned into one at the end after he realized that he might be into sex with guys a little bit. So that was Cruising. But what about Paul Bateson? He ended up serving 24 years and 3 months of his sentence, and he became eligible for parole in 1997. He was released from Arthur Kill Correctional Facility on Staten Island. Arthur Kill, what a name for a prison. In August of 2003, at the age of 63. The last public record of Bateson was that his parole was successfully completed in November of 2008. He was last known to have lived in the Long Island village of Freeport, but then moved on to parts unknown. A record in the Social Security Death Index shows that a Paul F. Bateson, with the same birth date, died on September 15, 2012. Oh, and here's an interesting fact. In the early 1990s, New York's gay community was once again stalked by a serial killer who targeted inebriated men leaving the city's gay bars late at night. Their bodies, or rather their body parts, Shudder, were found wrapped in garbage bags and dumped at highway rest stops and along roads outside the city. He was dubbed the Last Call Killer, and he wouldn't be caught by the police for almost a decade. This guy's name was Richard W. Rogers. He was eventually caught and sentenced to life in prison, and he would have been 23 years old at the time of the Cuppy bag murders, the ones that the cops wanted to connect Bateson to. So, that's interesting. Because that's just it. You can't call him a serial killer because it was really only proven that he committed one murder. But hearsay and that freaking story that he's told like five times have combined over the years to make Paul Bateson the trash bag murderer. Funny how that works. It's time for Wicked Good Gay. Our Wicked Good Gay for this episode is Michael Sam. Michael Allen Sam Jr. was born on January 7th, 1990. He's an American former professional football player who was the first publicly gay player, a defensive end, to be drafted into the NFL, which is crazy because football was so associated with America and masculinity and people's preconceptions about gay guys being effeminate, wispy. Just totally blown out of the water by Michael Sam. He was drafted by the NFL. Afterwards, he didn't really have a, great career. He actually didn't make the field, I guess. The Rams cut him during the final preseason roster cutdowns. Okay, you're right. I read that directly out of Wikipedia. I have no idea what it means. Someone translate. Thank you. He also spent time on the Dallas Cowboys practice squad before being waived, which means he was booted, not picked up, not allowed to play. But still, NFL drafted him. He also signed on in Montreal to play for the Canadian Football League, but that was kind of a bad time for him, too. He's now a motivational speaker as a profession. But still, first, openly gay football player to be drafted to the NFL. It's a big deal. And that's our Wicked Good Gay for this episode. Like I said, the source for that Wicked Good Gay was obviously Wikipedia. And so thank you to those people. And my sources for Cruising the Exorcist, the main one was Searching for the Truth About the Actual Murderer in The Exorcist, which is a really bad title for a news article, by Matt Miller in Esquire. That was the main one I used. All the audio clips came from YouTube. Our theme song is You Won't Get Away with Murder by Genie and the Goons. You can find them on Facebook and Spotify. Additional music by JB, cover art by Paul Chapman, and sound engineering by the other Mr. Harvey. Wicked Gay is on all of your major podcast apps, so please subscribe and review because it would mean so much to me. And if you're interested in what the people I podcast about look like, some of these evil people, I tend to put pictures of them up throughout the week on Wicked Gay's social media accounts. So look for Wicked Gay Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also wickedgaypod@gmail.com if you want to drop me a line, because I like drop lines. You've been listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things.